She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. This show is sponsored by the Chapman Automotive Group. Thank you so much for your support of Mrs. Green's World and for everything else you do to support the community and, in turn, the planet. Everybody, we have another truly amazing show with incredibly encouraging news that we're going to share with you today. It's great news for the planet, and it's reflective of what good things can happen with concerted efforts and multiple partners focused on a particular outcome. The name of our show today is Return of the Groundfish. And here to share with us the good news about that in a lot of detail is Sheila Bowman. She is the Seafood Watch Manager of Culinary and Strategic Initiatives at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, one of my favorite places on the planet. So welcome, Sheila, and thank you for being here to share some extraordinary great news about West Coast groundfish.
Thank you for having me.
I know, it's really exciting. And let me just do a short announcement for all of our Arizona listeners. I want to announce the winners of the 5th annual Arizona's Greenest Workplace Challenge. We had amazing statewide participation, and the winner of the award was selected by a statewide panel of judges. It's Wilson Produce. They're a family-owned business that grew from a family farm to a family of farms over the course of three generations. And very important to our food supply, the company is strategically located in Nogales at the foot of the food corridor. It feeds a really unbelievable amount of people in the United States and facilitates the distribution of fresh produce throughout the U.S. and Canada. Their efforts to create sustainable communities are truly epic. They're not just about their produce, but they're about solar, and no wonder the judges picked them. I had nothing to do with it. Was I happy with the results? And the People's Choice Award was another neck and neck race. We love watching the numbers for the People's Choice Awards, and it was Business Office Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. They are the ones that crossed the finish line. Congratulations to both of them and to all the great companies that participated. So, Sheila, now it's on with your show. And why don't we start with the very important mission of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, in case some of our listeners are not aware of this magnificent place on the planet.
Sure. Well, our mission here in Monterey, California, is to inspire the conservation of the oceans.
What a great, simple, impactful mission statement. You know, not 10 lines, conservation of the oceans. So it's unbelievable. And you are going to be, you had an anniversary, the 30th anniversary was in October?
Yes, we just passed 30 years here. And for the Seafood Watch program itself, 15 years. So two big anniversaries for us.
Unbelievable. So let's talk about the Seafood Watch program and what it does.
Sure. Well, our Seafood Watch program really was an offshoot of actually one of our exhibits in the Monterey Bay Aquarium, where we spent some time researching and sharing with our visitors sort of where their seafood comes from. And when we did this in the late 90s, it was before this kind of awareness and revolution around, you know, people being foodies and so interested in where our food came from. But it was, as you might imagine, very eye-opening. And even the staff, we were quite surprised to learn more about farm fishing and wild fishing and some of the impacts we were having on the oceans.
And, you know, it's really funny. Even since the birth of Mrs. Green, I'm only 6 years old. But now when I go to dinner with people and I'll bring up the Seafood Watch app or the little brochure, which I give out at all of the events that I, man the booth, people have it on their phones. They pull it out of their wallets. It's like it has spread immeasurably. So, and the recommendations are very simple. So can you just tell us what they are? There's just three recommendations based on where you are anywhere in the country. You can go to the app and find out if your seafood is safe.
Correct. And, you know, when we started all those years ago, we really did most of our work with our little paper pocket guides, as you refer to them.
Right,
and
right.
We've distributed over 50 million of those. And like you, I see some of them from 10 years ago that people have kept in their wallet and carried around, which is
quite dog-eared,
accomplishment. And you can't actually get them to replace it very easily because it's like their badge of caring and concern. And,
right.
Which is why the app is so wonderful. I mean, for a couple of reasons. First of all, a pocket guide goes out of date. We know that.
Quickly.
But it also only has about 70 recommendations. So it's nice, especially entry level, because you can get it for the seafood that's in your area. So if you're in the Northeast, you're going to see different things like quahog, clams, and bluefish, which you wouldn't see on the West Coast version, which is going to have, you know, rockfish and some of our species that we would see out here, like Dungeness crabs. So it's a great way to start things, and we certainly love when people carry pocket guides and spread them around and kind of plant the seeds of interest with other folks. But the app is really the great way to go on your phone, and it has over 2,700 recommendations. So it really gives you a lot more of your favorite fish to look at. And the nice thing is when you travel, like I was just in New York last week, I don't have to kind of worry about, do I have the right pocket guide? It's all right there on the app. And if anyone hasn't downloaded the app, we encourage you to do it. It's one of the easy things you can do that, like you said, pull it out in a restaurant, take a look, learn something about one fish at a time. 2,700 is a lot of recommendations.
It is.
But if we each look up our favorite fish, that is the best way to start.
Right. And you basically recommend best choices, good alternatives, and others to avoid, which is kind of what we're going to talk about, the big turnabout with the ground fish. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting, and I'm not sure at what point this all really mushroomed, but you have more than 1,000 businesses that look to the Seafood Watch Science to help guide their purchases. Is that a good number?
That probably is a low number. We have a lot of our major food service companies here in the United States who we all work with that have thousands of accounts, as well as you said, hundreds of smaller businesses and restaurants, everything from, you know, your local taqueria up to the finest dining table, white tablecloth kind of restaurants. We really are here to support and help these businesses move away from items on that red list. That's the first most important thing anyone can do, is really start to get away from those worst case scenario fisheries and fish farms.
And the thing is, you're right. That's why I said, is that a good number? Because you probably can't even track it. You don't know how many of the small little restaurants and businesses are downloading it to see what they should even purchase. So you can't, I mean, it's probably an untrackable number, but you do have two of the largest food service companies on the continent that are using it as the guide. So it's a huge impact.
It is a huge impact, and a lot of the retailers in this country are using the program and moving towards better purchasing. So for some of these larger businesses, as you can imagine, it doesn't happen overnight or even in the course of a year. It takes them years to source and switch some of what they're purchasing. But the commitment is there, and the real important thing is the reason they're doing it is because their consumers are saying, we want to know more about our food. We want to protect the oceans. We want to understand where you're purchasing our produce and our protein. So it's really been a very consumer-driven movement that, probably like most good things in this country, you know, started with the people and is moving through businesses. And we hope, as we're starting to see, even moves into the government so that regulation becomes more covering these kinds of concerns.
It's so encouraging. I mean, it really is. Anytime I say that a lot of my show, people have the power. All we have to do is use it. Get out of the consumer coma and start really demanding or requesting or at least indicating what it is that you want, and it will drive the market. I mean, the organic milk is a perfect example. Moms got together and said, we want organic milk, and guess what? We have organic milk now that has, you know, none of the growth hormones in it, so really good things can happen. So let's get on to the really big announcement. I think it is just, it's hard for me. I'm even prone to hyperbole, but to put in my enthusiasm how in a very relatively short time, West Coast ground fish, there's been a turnaround. They were declared a federal disaster, and now there's 21 species that have been upgraded. So you can talk about this, and I will ask questions to a fare thee well.
Perfect. Well, and let me just join you in hyperbole. I didn't think this was going to happen in my lifetime.
I can't believe it. When we got the announcement, I mean, Kelly was on the phone talking to Ken and saying, what? I mean, there's so much bad news. And to get a bulletin mm-hmm. like this was really a declaration of joy.
It's very true. And so maybe we should start by talking about what ground fish are.
Right, that's
ground
perfect.
Fish are literally the group of fish that live right against the seafloor. So people who are familiar with a halibut, you understand that's a flatfish that lives
right.
on the bottom.
Right.
But living next door and with, you know, in that same neighborhood are species like the sablefish, which on this coast we also sometimes call black cod.
Right.
Just a delicious fish. My probably favorite fish in the ocean, which is the rockfish. We have hundreds of species of those fish off this coast, and one of the reasons we all thought that they would take so long to recover is these fish live well over 100 years. So you can imagine they have a similar lifespan to humans. They similarly don't start reproducing until they're maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years old. And so if you start to catch those fish and really take most of those mature fish out of the population and onto the dinner table, you can imagine that it would take a while for those fish populations to recover. So that was one of the species groups. And you'll see them in the store. Sometimes they're called Pacific snapper.
Right. People are familiar with snapper, right.
Sometimes you see them as rock cod in this area. We'll see it that way. It's just a lovely, moist, white, flaky fish and like I said, delicious in just about any way you cook it. And then there's also things on the list that might not be so familiar to people. Things like the lingcod,
right.
which is something that scuba divers and spear fishermen have known about forever. And it's now on a list that we all can start to get to know them. So some good things on that list.
And there are fish lovers that are going to hear the show and be jumping up and down and clicking their heels because there is, I mean, it is a, you know, much sought after healthy choice to have fish on your in your diet, and the beat goes on. Now, does the, in the putting together of the best choice or good alternative or avoid, is it, what all goes into that? Aren't there many environmentally responsible seafood observations that are made to give them those ratings?
Correct. So just to be clear, because so many people ask us this question, we really are looking at the environmental impact of a fishery and a fish farm.
Okay.
So that when you look at that recommendation, which as you mentioned is a red to avoid, a yellow is an alternative, a green, which is the best choices where you should be heading. You know, we put a lot of thought into what is the impact of taking that fish out of the water or raising it on a farm. So you can imagine with these ground fish, I just described how they live on the bottom.
Right.
The way you collect them is essentially kind of raking the bottom, raking the seafloor. So that's how you would pick them up. And, of course, as you pick up the fish you want, you pick up all kinds of other species you didn't want.
The bycatch, right.
The bycatch, the things that, you know, kind of make up the habitat where those fish live. And as you can imagine, if you rake that up too many times, it's no longer a great neighborhood for fish to live in. You've destroyed their habitat. So one of the things we look at is, you know, these impacts of the fishing gear. We also look at how many fish are we catching. You know, there's no great way to catch a fish that is already in very low numbers. Things
right.
like our Pacific bluefin tuna are in such low numbers that we just need to leave them alone, let them rebound, get their numbers back up. But I think it's also interesting we look at things like, you know, the human management. What have we humans learned about the fish and their biology that lets us manage them effectively, close the season to let them reproduce, set the quotas or the numbers so we catch the right amount, and regulate, but then also enforce those regulations? And those are some of the important pieces that came together for this groundfish fishery on this coast. Was the fishermen certainly did their part, but the management was innovative and thoughtful and really came up with ways to continue that fishery, upgrade that fishery, and keep it open, which is so important. We don't want to close our local fisheries and lose those coastal businesses and those, you know, here in Monterey, we are a fishing village.
And it affects so many businesses and people's way of living. I mean, their economic stability. It's not just getting the customers to eat good fish. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a ripple effect for the economy of any fishing community like Monterey. It's why people go
Absolutely.
There. Okay,
So that's important to us, is maintaining those fisheries, maintaining the onshore coastal community. You know, no fish, no fishermen. Lots of fish, smart fishermen. We're going to be set to have fish on our table for a long time.
So in the you know, from my research, there was literally a federal disaster declaration done for fisheries in 2000. That is what started as it was kind of the impetus. So that some of the factors in that were overfish species, right?
Absolutely.
And did you have to do closures? Did you have to stop fishing? How was the monitoring done? Talk a little bit about the meat of what was started to be implemented, because 14 years is a really fast turnaround for the disaster that it was. That's what I keep saying. I mean, 50 years might be expected, but 14?
Right. Unbelievable. Well, you're absolutely right. The fishery was declared a disaster, and that is a result of the fishery biologists who go out, look at how many fish are there. Are they the old fish that are reproducing and sustaining the population? Are they all juveniles that aren't doing that kind of work? Are they in great enough numbers that, you know, it's a big ocean out there. Can fish A find fish B to even reproduce? So it's those kinds of important things. Were we really managing the fishery effectively to kind of help those fish stay, the populations stay healthy? So some of it was just a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. Some of it was a situation where we didn't have good regulations and enforcement. You know, one of the things that's really true about it is we really had a lot of boats out there, probably too many boats. So
right.
One of the things that this management step did was reduce the number of permits that were allowed to catch this fish, so that, you know, you don't have X number of fish and then 10X number of boats out there.
Right. And then nobody wins. I mean, dilutes it. Exactly.
It does. And, you know, when Monterey was a fishing village, you know, we have a great history of fishing, over 100 years of various groups coming in and innovating with their boats and their gears. And, of course, we had the great sardine fishery here in the middle of the 1900s. And so we have a tradition of being on the sea. But the thing we sometimes forget is that as we've been fishing these fish, we've developed hydraulic winches and diesel engines and sonar and radar and all of these things that really do shift the advantage from the fish populations to us. We know where they are, where they're going to be, where they're not. So we really have become very, very effective fishermen. And as a result of that, we have to keep an eye on, are we so effective or too effective that we're taking too many fish?
And, you know, it's really kind of mind-boggling when you describe that. I mean, it's from the days of literally fishermen going out in boats and dropping lines to now being able to track by sonar and all of these modern technological advances where they should go and what's out there. I mean, it's pretty amazing to just sit here and see in a very short amount of time of our history the technological and other kinds of advances. So we are going to have a very short break. I told you time would fly. And for anybody who just tuned in, we're having a wonderful interview about really good news. The name of the show is The Return of the Groundfish. Here with us today to share about that is Sheila Bowman, Seafood Watch Manager of Culinary and Strategic Initiatives at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And we're talking about, to me, what I think is one of the most important success stories about ecological and economic recovery definitely in my lifetime. Would you agree with that, Sheila?
Agreed.
So when we come back, we're going to talk more about, I know, it's like I am goofy about it. We'll talk more about what some of the chefs are saying, what some of the other people in the industry are saying. Please stay here with me. Lots more good information to come. We'll be right back. There, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
Find everything you need for your next adventure at Bookman Sports Exchange. Buy it new, buy it used, or trade up and go where you've never been before. Explore this big backyard we call Tucson. Bookman Sports Exchange has the gear you need for anything from a quick day hike in Sabino to a long backpacking trip through the Grand Canyon. Bookman Sports Exchange, open daily, located on Speedway, east of Country Club. For details and more information, visit bookmansports.com.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And certainly our guest today is giving us a lot of really great information to think about. If you just joined us, our guest today is Sheila Bowman. She is the Seafood Watch Manager of Culinary and Strategic Initiatives at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Our show topic is return of the groundfish and how unprecedented improvements in many areas has resulted in an incredible turnaround for 21 commercially important species of fish to the West Coast region of our country. Sheila, again, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you.
And we mentioned a little bit about, you know, there were multiple partners in this, but can you talk a little bit about the U.S. fisheries, the new management rules set by Congress in 2006, and how those impacted what happened and what is the world watching? I mean, is it impacting other nations around the world? I don't expect you to be an expert on all of the world's fishing, but just talk a little bit about the management rules and how that helped maybe accelerate or impact this great news.
Sure. Well, of course, as we were saying, the management, the human part of this story is such an important piece. It's really kind of proves out that if we do things right, we can see better improvement in our food system and, of course, in our environment as well. You know, here in the U.S., we do have good policies for our fisheries. We want them to be managed in a sustainable way. And if you're a fishery manager, which is something you can be at a federal level or a local level, you know, you have a lot of tools in your toolbox. And the key thing is understanding the target of your fishery and really trying to do what you can to manage the fishery around that biology, around that understanding. So, you know, if you are fishing an animal that has a certain place where it spawns or reproduces, you know, one of the key things is give those fish that place and that time so that they can reproduce. I would say that that makes a lot of sense, but we have a lot of fisheries around the world where the fishery goes to the place where the fish are reproducing to catch them.
I know, and so they devastate the whole habitat. Yes, it's done.
Yeah, you can see the short-sightedness of that. So that, those are some of the fish that sort of end up on our red list is when they're managed in those kinds of poor ways. But You can close an area. You can look at closing a season. We have a lot of fish out here. If you're a recreational fisherman, you know that you can't catch a crab or a salmon under a certain size. So leave the juveniles out there to, you know, get to the point where they're
again.
Reproducing. Exactly. So they're kind of common sense things that really help the fishery, the fish populations thrive. So we need to keep those kinds of regulations and, of course, the enforcement of those regulations moving forward in this country. We're doing a pretty good job. As I said, all of our fisheries here are mandated to be sustainable, and we look to see that happening in the next, hopefully, years, in some cases decades, but we're on track for that, and that's great news. I think the thing that we all need to keep in mind is that only 9% of the fish we eat in this country comes from U.S. fisheries.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding.
So we are leading the way, and we're doing great work here in the U.S., but the other 91% of the fish we eat is coming from countries that don't have those kinds of regulations and enforcement. So we need to, as consumers and as businesses in this country, reach out and try to help those fisheries and those fish farms step up to the standards that we want. We certainly do that with other foodstuffs where we don't have certain pesticides or chemical usage. We don't like to see social, injustices in our food chain. So this environmental concern is something that we are spreading to especially businesses that are sending fish to our country.
And, I think this may be, that is a shocking statistic to me. I thought I knew a lot about this whole fishing industry and Oceana, the work that they're doing, and the incredible consciousness, but it's maybe because I live in the United States. I know other countries are getting on board because it's their livelihood, and it's the primary source of protein for millions of people in the world. I do have to ask you this, though, and I'm glad that I didn't forget. So how did it come about that it was 21 fish exactly? I mean, you were part of the, is that a putting you on the spot question? How come not 19? How come not 25? How were these 21 fish identified to be upgraded? Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yes. Well, and I think it's important to realize that there are more than 21 fish that live on the bottom of the ocean here off the coast.
Exactly.
It was, I've already told you there's, 100 species of rockfish. So what this is indicative of is those 21 species are at a good number, they're healthy populations and we can be consuming them. There are a lot of fish still out there, including several species of rockfish that are still on the red list. So anyone who's out there catching these fish needs to be aware that their method, the amount of fish that they can take, really has to keep in mind sort of the least successful species right now. You can't keep catching yellowtail rockfish at the expense of some of the other rockfish species that are still rebuilding, that aren't on the path to be yellow or green yet.
Right, right.
So the 21 species is the ones that are there and have crossed the finish line. There's still lots of species out there, including many in this fishery, that aren't there yet. But they're on the right path. I think that's the important thing. And with this kind of management, we see them getting to those improved conditions.
And it's got to be encouraging for everybody, including the fishermen. So I want to ask you about those 21 species. Were they close to, collapsing? Were they ready to disappear entirely in 2000?
I think probably the species that you're seeing there are the ones that are the more numerous fish.
Okay.
So I couldn't answer specifically, but okay. I know the fish that still are on the red list are the ones that are probably were in worse condition and are not as able to quickly rebound. Certain, fish that look a lot alike can have very different biology.
So it's really, okay. And then what about, I'm always very interested in the position of the fisherman, because that's really the key to where it all starts. In the United States and in the partners that you worked with, is it a rigorous education process? Are fishermen aware of it? What was the sense of the participation for the fishermen in making this happen? Because at the end of the day, if they're not conforming to the regulations, which is hard to monitor. As you said, it's a big ocean out there. What has been their position? And is it a united front? I know that's a long question, but you get what I mean. Mm-hmm. Where were the fishermen in this process?
Well, you know, I think the fishermen obviously are on the front lines with this. They're the ones who are out there, and they certainly have knowledge of the fish and where they are, and certainly have ideas about what should be caught and when. We balance that real world experience, which is so difficult. You can imagine the oceans. You don't know how many fish are out there. And the way people figure that out is using science. So there's a whole arm of fishery management and fishery biology that's about sampling populations, pulling fish up, looking at, you know, are they all the same sex? Are they all the same age? Or is there a healthy population of older fish and younger fish, males and females? Are they spread over a wide area? Are they just found in small pockets? Are there a lot more of them than there were the last time you counted? Are there a lot less of them than the last time you counted? All of that kind of, well, and you're literally doing a pretty sort of casting a net overboard and
counting.
It's like putting your hand in the Halloween candy basket and hoping that you get the chocolate you're after. So
what a great analogy, the day after Halloween. I mean, it's perfect.
It's the same kind of idea. And if you put your hand in that basket often enough, you start to know what's in there, what's rare, what there's a lot of, what there's not a lot of. So that's how fishery biology works. And so the science balances, of course, what the fishermen know. And if those two groups work together, you really start to see this kind of success. That's the piece that makes this groundfish announcement so extraordinary, is that the fishermen and the scientists really worked hand in hand. They really made the kind of, in some cases, sacrifices. You know, if you had 400 boats and the science told you you could only really support about 90 boats, that meant a lot of people had to shift to a different fishery or give up fishing.
Yeah, it's tough. That's really tough.
That's
when you
tough.
Said that, that's very, very tough. Who's in and who's out? I mean, it's for some people that it's all they've done their whole life, and it's multi-generational. Mm-hmm. So it's a really big shift. Let me ask you this. So is there a benefit also to the fishermen? I mean, we can talk about how we know it benefits the fishing communities. It's certainly great for seafood consumers, but does it give more flexibility to fishermen to actually fish for what they want and know that it's okay?
I think that's the piece that we've had the hardest time convincing everybody about.
Okay.
But as these groups, and we've had a few examples on this coast and around the country, as these fisheries and these fishermen kind of pull together a model that's more sustainable, the right number of fishermen, the right, you know, amount of fish to be caught, you know, you do start to see the individuals become more successful. So if you're not out there competing with hundreds of boats, you're out there competing for your share with 90, and you have a quota that's set that you know that you're assured to get, that's a much more stable situation than kind of what we see with TV shows like The Deadliest Catch, where it's like you go out there and it's a rodeo and you hope you get your piece of the pie.
Right.
So this is better for fishermen that way. We also know that if you know, there's ways you can manage a fishery that they're optimized, and that's where we're headed. So if you have so few fish that they're hard to catch, that's never going to be as good for a fisherman than a more sustainable, healthy population where there's a lot of fish and they're available.
So what happens when who decides when a marine protected area is designated as a safeguard to the vulnerable habitat? Who and how is that decision made? We're going to close off this area. How is that enforced? I mean, that's a complex question, but I'm sure you know exactly what I'm getting at. When you have a marine protected area, what goes into the decision making for that complex process?
Right. Well, and it's all about the science, and you can imagine it's actually easier for scientists to map the seafloor and understand where you've got rocky areas that, you know, rockfish like to live in rocky areas, where you have sandy areas where flatfish like to live, and we understand the biology of these fish well enough to know, like, what does it take for them to have the food they need, to find other fish to reproduce with, to have the habitat where those little baby fish can settle down and nestle in and grow up. And we, the way you make them a protected area is you get all of, find the places where those resources are all available, and you designate that as such. And for this particular fishery, you know, that was a real key. You can fish over in one area.
Right.
You're dragging the seafloor, you're catching those fish, but you're leaving the other area protected so that the fish reproduce, the baby fish are there, and then when they sort of radiate out from a protected area into where the fishery's operating, those are the fish you're catching. So it's really about, for this particular fishery, it's a, you know, fishery management back to the toolbox. They can use GPS to locate fisher and fishermen and where they are. Onboard observers are a big contributor so that you can look at what's going on and make
right.
sure that you understand the fishery. So those are two ways to kind of help with that enforcement.
And it's, I mean, some of the things, the guests I've had, because I'm so blessed that I get to go to the Sustainable Foods Institute each year, and I think I'm still on track for the next one in 2015, and I learned about fish tagging. I mean, things like that, from where in some areas of the country in the Gulf, fish are actually being tagged by the fishermen, and they follow it to your plate. And it's just, mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty, that's the science and the incredible, you can really literally know your fishermen, and that gets me pretty excited. What about the, tell me what some of the, you know, what are the chefs saying? Are they rejoicing overall up and down the coast? Because it isn't just California, it's Washington and Oregon as well, that there's mm-hmm. there was general rejoicing, right? It's the West Coast area.
Well, absolutely. I mean, some of these fish haven't been available for people to cook with for decades. So people obviously very excited. Many of the fishermen trying to hook up with those chefs to start bringing the fish off the boats into these restaurants where they're appreciated and loved. So chefs always are interested in a diversity of fish.
Right,
you know,
right.
I think as Americans, we eat so much salmon, shrimp, and tuna. And chefs say to me all the time, you know, the best fish are the sardines and some of these, like the porgy, and some of these fish that you and I don't maybe even know the names of.
Right.
But those are fish that are tasty and delicious. And if we just let ourselves go and put ourselves in the hands of these chefs, that's where we're going to find delicious food and, again, diversify our diet, which is so important. We can't ever just count on the oceans to give us salmon, shrimp, and tuna.
Right. The three top ones, you're absolutely,
you know,
right.
9 billion of us can't just eat those three. So that's my other thing that I would definitely encourage everyone listening to do, which is, you know, if you see a fish out there, I mean, 10 years ago, no one had heard of tilapia. Now tilapia, probably most people have tried. So, you know, when you see rockfish, give it a try. Try something new.
And you're right. People didn't ever even hear that. It's the big three that you mentioned. And I think mm-hmm. in some of the research that you sent me, what I loved about the enthusiasms of the chefs, what you're excited about, what I think every listener is going to be excited about, is that bringing the oceans back to good health and turning the fisheries around when you work together can happen. And here's the proof. It wasn't just a little bit of good news. It was like a big wow.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that if we celebrate these success stories and really put our, you know, our money where our mouth is and support these kinds of fisheries and continue to stay away from what's on the red list, because we still have a lot of work to do.
Right. But we're not there yet.
Compared to where we started, there's just so many things. There's just really not a single chef I work with that we can't find something delicious, sometimes even local, that they can put on that menu and feel great about, as opposed to bringing in another, you know, salmon from the other side of the world in a farm that's really polluting the environment, or a fish like a bluefin tuna that's just been so overfished that we need to leave them alone. You know, the things on the red list don't excite chefs. We need to start eating what's on the green list.
And it's wonderful when the chefs get ignited, because there again, it's the people have the power to request it, but the chefs have the power to promote it, to promote different options. So we are coming up upon another break. And when we come back, Sheila, I'd love to talk to you a little bit about, I have some general questions about what are some of the environmental considerations around farmed and wild-caught fisheries, and what Seafood Watch does, your criteria, and if we have time, I'm very enthralled and kind of saddened by what's happening with the starfish. So everybody, you can tell there's a lot more left. Please stay here with us. We're enjoying great information with Sheila Bowman, Seafood Watch Manager of Culinary and Strategic Initiatives at Monterey Bay. Stay here with me, everybody.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
The Habit Store is a big operation with staff and volunteers working hard to reduce our carbon footprint. We sell donated building materials, furniture and appliances, and recycle the metal from items that we can't repair or sell. We even have solar panels on the roof. The good deals we offer shoppers means Tucson Habitat can build and renovate homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. If you just joined us, our guest today is Sheila Bowman, Seafood Watch Manager of Culinary and Strategic Initiatives. What a long title that is, my friend, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Our show topic is return of the groundfish and how unprecedented improvements in many areas has resulted in an incredible turnaround for 21 commercially important species of fish to the West Coast region of our country. And before we get on with my questions, two quick reminders. Mrs. Green's World Membership Program is alive and growing. We ask that you become an official supporter of Mrs. Green's World to help keep broadcasts like this free and independent. It's really easy to become a member by visiting our website at Mrs. Green's World and look for Become a Sustainer Choice on the menu bar, and we hope you'll do just that. And another quick reminder is, you know how excited I am that we have an app now. So there's an app for Mrs. Green's World to listen to our podcast. It's called Igloo Radio. And again, visit our homepage, click on Download Free, where you see the little Igloo icon, and you are there. People are loving it, and so are we. So Sheila, again, thanks for being with us. And if we can, let's talk about some general questions about what are the environmental considerations around farmed and wild-caught fisheries?
Sure. Well, we went through most of the ones we use for wild-caught fisheries, habitat damage, the bycatch, the stock status. Things are going to change when you're looking at farmed fish. It's going to be things like what kind of chemicals might they use, what kind of pollution might the farm be producing, and how is that being managed. Where do they get the baby fish or baby oysters that they're farming? What happens if those little fish escape into the environment? Do they have an impact? We look at those kinds of things and several others as our way of assessing kind of how a farm is operating. And really, if you think about it, it's not too much different to farm fish than it is to farm chickens or cows. It's really the same idea of there's artisanal or carefully done kinds of farming where you've got lower numbers of fish in the cage, so you get fewer diseases, and therefore you need fewer antibiotics and different chemicals. You've got farms that are in the middle of the ocean, so all of the pollution kind of just floats away, versus farms that are on the land where all the fish poop and other kinds of waste products can even be turned into a manure-type product. So we look at all of those things. It really, again, is an approach where what the humans and the business people decide to do really can make a difference between a farm being on our red list versus a farm farming the same species in a more careful way being on our green list.
And it's the thought of it boggles my mind, because if it's a bad fish farm, it's really a bad fish farm, and people really don't want to eat things from there. And it just, you know, from the consumer point of view, it's kind of like a big, I better know what I'm putting in my mouth and in my body.
It's very true. And as you might imagine, yes, there can be things that you wouldn't, if you knew about it, you wouldn't eat it. So it's important, I think, to be informed. And I think most people are like, well, I don't really eat farm fish. I think it's really important to know that over half the fish we're eating is farmed. So the trout, the tilapia, the Arctic char, all of our shellfish, most of our shrimp are all coming in from farms. So it's just really important to understand. And as a consumer, the most important thing you can probably do is ask whoever's selling you your fish, that fishmonger, that wait person at a restaurant, where's this fish from? Is it farmed? Is it wild? You know, some of those things that let them understand that you want to know more about the food that you're eating. I always use this example. There's restaurants here in California that will tell you exactly where your peach came from, the name of the peach farmer,
exactly
the where he's located here in California, the county, you know, in some cases the variety of the peach, and then it'll just say tuna. And it's, you know, you can't know everything about a peach and not understand that you could know a similar amount of information about your tuna. And it's so important to understand that and make better choices.
There's a lot of hashtags in this conversation. I mean, it really is. It's true. Know your fishermen. Know where your fish came from. And, you know, I make a habit of asking when I'm out to dinner fish choices, and I ask the wait staff, where is it from? And I would say, you know, you get to know the restaurants where the chef, or in most cases the owner, really does know. And in a lot of cases, the wait staff, they don't know. And it's like there's a look of consternation, but they're always willing to go ask. And sometimes I don't like the answers. I mean, but that tells me everything. It's like it's not necessarily a priority for that restaurant. Maybe they have some other great things. But it is, the important message you're giving is, as a consumer, just start asking the questions, and then the restaurants and the chefs will start caring more. So,
and I can't overemphasize that that's a process, because it may not get you a sustainable seafood dinner that night.
Right.
You may not
like
the answers, and you may realize, okay, this this restaurant is either doesn't know, or they're telling me everything that's on the red list, which is terrible. So I usually try to leave them a pocket guide. But what it does, and I can tell you from sort of the other, you know, the back door of the kitchen, is it starts the conversation in that establishment. So you may feel as a consumer like, well, it didn't do any good. I went back the next week and they still didn't know. But I'm here to tell you that those kinds of conversations are how the change comes about. It may not happen the first time you ask. It may not even happen the 10th time you ask. But for the restaurants that are on the move, that's the kind of impetus that moves them towards better programming and calling us up. It's amazing. They give us a call and start working with us to make those better choices.
It's the power of the people. I mean, we said it earlier in the show, and it's literally planting seafood seeds when you're going around. And the same in the grocery stores. I mean, if you want the grocery stores to start bringing on the good, healthy choices, I'm really very shocked, and I didn't have any idea that one half of the fish we eat is farmed. I mean, I think that's a statistic I'll certainly put out in our social media. And I don't think most people that consume fish are aware that the number is that high. Do you agree?
Well, can I give you another statistic?
Yeah, I mean,
we are farming
all day long.
We are farming, everything tipped in about the last year, and we are farming more fish than we are cows.
You are kidding me.
Fish farming surpassed beef, the farming of beef.
I'm writing
that down.
it's
a sector of our food system that is growing and is expanding, and so it's why it's so important that we continue to stay on it and do it right, because this is a good time to lay down these great practices, as opposed to, for example, in the world of beef, where, you know, conventional beef is really very established, and it's hard to get them to shift towards better practices,
right,
towards the pasture-raised and the organic and
right,
those kinds of things.
I had Howard Lyman on my show, The Mad Cowboy, and, I mean, he's got a lot to say about that whole entire thing. Of course, he is totally vegan, but he does have a lot of really good science to back up what you need to look for if you are going to eat beef. So is it safe to say that what you're advocating is to add your consumption of fish to your other practices of sustainability that you will for your other food, like you're watching and seeing the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 for your fruits mm-hmm. and vegetables. So add sustainability of your fish to your list of how it's measuring up.
Absolutely. And when we talk to people about this, you know, it's always like, well, I'm eating locally. So what you want to do is find a fish that's on our green list that's local to you. It's not going to trade off that you could eat a local fish that was on the red list. That's not a good trade off. So adding that green list and really trying to up the better practices is something that we should all be trying to do as often as we can. I mean, the one thing that we do know is seafood is probably one of the most sustainable things you can eat. So when you compare a farmed fish to a farmed cow, there's going to be a lot less greenhouse gases and other kinds of impacts.
Right.
So fish is great in your diet. It can be obviously very healthy in your diet. Many of us, not all of us, can get something local. If you're in the middle of the country, the Great Lakes has got some choices on the green list. So there's a lot of ways that seafood makes sense. And so what we're trying to do is get people to just pick the right seafood.
I know
when you're out there,
if you're in
choose
Tucson.
Those greenless seafood.
Yes.
Eat it twice a week and, you know, enjoy.
And if you're in Tucson, please don't tell me that you're sourcing your fish locally, because that would be a stretch.
Exactly.
But we have some great chefs that bring it in and they're committed to it. And you know what restaurants that they operate, and people go there for that reason, because they're following what I call the good rules and making sure that what they're putting on their plates are sustainable and healthy and not having a negative impact on the environment. But they are not
exactly
locavores.
And, you know, anywhere you go, I just would encourage people. It's a little bit of a game, because I have been to restaurants. My husband took me to a restaurant for my birthday, and there were many, many red list items. And so it was a game. Can I find something that was on the green list?
Right.
And I ended up eating a whole lot of oysters, which were delicious, and some Dungeness crab, which is delicious. So if you look at it sort of from what are the opportunities, as opposed to I can't believe I can't eat that one
right,
fish anymore.
Right. The glass is half full.
Exactly.
Yes, and make
you
it fun.
Turn it around a little.
That's right. It's not a heavy-duty thing, but it certainly is heavy-duty in terms of ignoring it for the impact it can have on your health and on the planet. So let's talk about something that I think is fun, and I don't know a lot about it, and I'm sure you do know more. I heard it talked about at the Institute, the emergence of trash fish approach. Talk about that. What does that even mean?
Well, trash fish is quite literally a fisherman's term for seafood that he would catch. For example, if you're out there looking for flatfish and you end up with some other fish in your net, and they just didn't have any value. They may have been delicious and tasty, but they brought it back to shore and nobody knew that fish, so nobody wanted to buy that fish. So they would just throw it overboard as trash, or in many cases bring it home, and that's what the fisherman's family would eat, because it was probably something pretty delicious. So even things like sardines originally were thought to be very much a trash
wow.
fish. And up in Alaska, there's certain types of salmon that are revered, the Chinook salmon, and other species that were thought to be a little less, just not as good. So they were considered more of a trash salmon. So it's interesting how, though, if you put those kinds of fish into the right hands, they can be delicious. So we have a lot of chefs that are trying to use trash fish, which is a certainly tension-getting term. I don't like that term, and others are like, but it's a great marketing term because it does get people's attention, and people will come in and try something they've never tried before. And hopefully, you know, you have certain things on the East Coast. People love monkfish. Well, that was a trash fish 10 years ago, but now it's a delicacy. So it gives you some idea that what we don't know may be the next favorite food item.
Right. Don't be looking down your nose at that, because it might be the thing that you're fighting to get in the grocery store because it's
exactly.
Now,
and, you know,
it's now in.
I work with a lot of chefs, and it's amazing what you see them eating. I mean, that's where there's good fish flavor, and they really enjoy certain things that the rest of us haven't caught on with. I mean, sardines is a perfect example, and mackerel. If you haven't eaten mackerel, you're missing the boat.
You're missing the boat. Oh, my gosh. So a lot of fish lovers out there listening are salivating. So the two more things that I would like to talk to you about and make sure that we don't run out of time. One is, what is the call to action? How can people, consumers listening and people that will listen to the podcast, best stay on top of what's happening? Obviously, the app. The Seafood Watch app, I would say, would be the number one way to know your fishermen, know your fish. Is that?
That's a great way. And, you know, I think if you go in there and look up your favorite fish, if you really love porgy, go look it up and read its story. You know, I hope everybody who's hearing me talk today about the rockfish will go in and look up rockfish and just learn a little bit more. And those bits of information that you accumulate let you kind of become a better informed and consumer and foodie. You know what to ask for when you're out at these restaurants. So going to the app, and you'll notice that we update it once a month. So really, you'll be the first to know when things change like this.
About what's happening. I mean, it's a pretty amazing creation and such a rejoicing of modern technology to help with people's health and the health of the planet.
Right.
You can tell I'm a fan. And then we don't have a lot of time left, and I don't know, I certainly don't want to put you on the spot, but I watched a special on PBS the other night, and I was almost sad that I did. But it's funny, Sheila, I immediately thought of what role, if any, will the Monterey Bay Aquarium have in it, and that's the alarming disappearance of the starfish and this malady that's attacking them. I mean, what do you have any quick comment on that?
Well, sure. We have off the coast noticed for about the past year or so what we're calling sea star wasting syndrome. It's a tongue
twister. Yeah, no kidding.
It's, you know, we have lots of people out that are in the tide pools and diving, and they're seeing these sea stars that have just kind of either a moldy sort of look or some kind of...
like white lesions?
White lesions or loss of limbs, and they just don't look like a healthy sea star does.
Right,
so
right.
We have, you know, there's certainly people out there networking. Where is this being found, and what's the geographic range? And I mean, the good news is that we're not seeing it really spread. It seems to be here along the coast, but not really moving north or south. So
that's good.
We don't really know.
Right.
We just don't really know. It's having a major impact on sea star populations.
And it's really early on. I mean, it's not a long-term thing that you've been able to study. So I will just ask you to please give our very best from everyone on the Mrs. Green team to our friends at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Give Jennifer a hug for me. I've loved having her on the show. And everybody, please get involved with the Seafood Watch program. It's going to make our world a better place. We're big supporters of all your great work. And next week, I want to forward promote on November 4th, the Tohono Autumn Community Action Program for our local series, Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, sponsored by the Desert Diamond Casino. Terrell Johnson, the CEO of that program, is going to be on. And then on November 8th, James Costa is going to be our guest His new, recently released film, Lunch Hour, is somewhat shocking yet very informative show about what we know we're serving our kids in schools. You don't want to miss this one. Sheila Bowman, thank you so much for being on the show and for everything you do. Everybody, make it a great green week.